So last Sunday, we had an open discussion period, and one thing that got brought up was about the famous story about the sixth ancestor. And what I wanted to do was use that opportunity from last Sunday to actually talk about that, because it's a very good story to give you a better sense of how we approach things in our practice. So going to the scripture book, you all recited the ancestral line, the last scripture that we sung. And basically what that is, it's a recitation. So Buddhism being a monastic tradition, I mean, it's not exclusively a monastic tradition by any means, but in the monastic tradition, what we do is, as I think I've mentioned to some people, is that it's sort of like a tree with different branches. And you have the initial historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, and he had lots and lots and lots of disciples and passed on the teaching. Think of that as being in quotes. It's not quite like handing you a textbook on advanced mathematics and here, read this and learn this. It's not quite like that. And in our particular lineage, being a Soto Zen tradition, we basically have this listing of monks, teachers who passed on their teaching to, well, many monks, but one monk in particular, who then passed it on to another student who became a teacher and so on. And on the second page, top sort of left column, a few names down, there's the word Bodhidharma, Bodhidharma Daiyosho. Daiyosho is Japanese for great priest, great teacher, which you get that title once you're dead. Once you're dead and you've actually passed on something, so there's somebody who can actually acknowledge that, yes, I'm grateful for that person to have passed these on to me. So Bodhidharma was a monk back in southern India who traveled all the way to China in about the time 520 AD. And so he actually brought that tradition to China from India and started what became Chan Buddhism in China. Chan is the Chinese word for jhana, which is a Sanskrit word basically indicating the form of meditation that we do. So he basically, you know, the tradition continued from India to China. And then we get to the name Daimon Konin. And he was a Chinese Buddhist monk. He was the abbot of a very large temple. And he's considered the fifth Chinese ancestor. And then along came a fellow who was from a very poor family. He was illiterate. And he was walking through a marketplace, the story goes, and he heard a monk reciting verses from what's called the Diamond Sutra. Sutra being a Sanskrit word for scripture or teaching. And the Diamond Sutra is a very, very important, very revered scripture in our tradition. And basically he heard just a verse or two of that scripture and he realized that he wanted to start practicing, start finding out, you know, what is this really pointing to? Where did this come from? And there are quite a few stories like that throughout the ages where somebody, just some normal Joe or Jill, comes across hearing some teachings or seeing some Buddhist person conducting themselves, just carrying on, and it just pings something in them. So he was this particular monk. It's not a monk yet. This person practicing, wanting to practice and deepen his understanding of Buddhism. He was from the south of China. And there's this thing that goes on between the north and south of China, apparently. And I had to smile. It's like, okay, this is, what is this? Not quite 2,000 years ago. Yeah, 1,500 years ago. It's like, okay, 1,500 years on, we're still doing the same thing. Oh, you're from the south. Oh, you're from the east. You're from the north. So basically, the person who became the sixth ancestor, he had heard that this particular abbot was the person he should go to, the person he should ask for teaching from, should go and train with. So what's traditional oftentimes is that when somebody goes to a monastery, they usually have an audience with the abbot. So the abbot can kind of check them out. And vice versa, of course. Okay, so he's meeting with the abbot, and the abbot says to him, "Where do you come from?" So his name was Enno. Enno answered, he says, "From south of the southern pass." And the abbot asks, "What do you want above all else?" And Enno replied, "I seek only to become a Buddha." Part of me is like, whoa. So then the abbot says, "Southerners do not have the Buddha nature, so how can you realize Buddhahood?" And then Enno answered, "Amongst people, there are Southerners and there are Northerners. What has the Buddha nature to do with that?" This is an incredibly profound answer, which I'll try to unpack a bit more. But basically, the abbot realized, whoa. Okay, we have somebody here who has some substance to him. And then he said, okay, you can basically come be part of this community. And the job is that you're going to work in the rice pounding shed, which was very hard work, very, very menial work. It was probably one of the lowest things that you would do in the monastery. And the story goes that Enno did this for 2 years. Okay, so that's where the story begins. That's how it unfolds. So one doesn't know how often he would have met with the abbot during those 2 years. Certainly, I mean, that was his monastic job, but every monk in the monastery goes and, like we did this morning, you all have meditation together. You do morning service together. You do other ceremonial eat meals together and so on. But then in between those times, his particular job would have been to pound rice. And as far as I understand it, pounding rice in part has to do with what, threshing it, you know, getting the husk off of it, sort of taking brown rice and turning it into white rice, which is kind of how they did it traditionally. Then also just making it suitable for eating and so on. So yes, he was doing that particular monastic job, but then he was also, as with all the other monks, churning in. And so the abbot Daimon, he said, realizing that the time for transmission had arrived, told his assembly of monks, "It's hard to explain. It is not enough to vainly memorize what I say and proclaim it as your own. Let each of you compose a poem according to your own understanding. The one whose phrases tally most profoundly with the intent of the teaching will receive both the kesa and the teaching." Now, when he says the time for transmission had arrived, what that's basically meaning is that the transmission is the time when a teacher or master passes on traditional teachings to a disciple, thereby making them a teacher in their own right. And it's the way the tradition gets passed on, carried on. And so the abbot was undoubtedly getting older, and he was also just sensing something was going on in the monastery with his disciples, and he wanted his monks to compose a poem for him to basically impart their understanding. And notice what he says, though, too. He says, "It is not enough to vainly memorize what I say and proclaim it as your own." So the transmission, the passing on of the teaching, they have this phrase where they say basically the transmission is beyond words. It doesn't have anything to do with passing on the understanding that one would gain through reading books or reading, you know, talks by other teachers. Those are only important. The readings and so on are important as part of your overall practice to actually realize this deeper truth for yourself experientially. He's asking his monks to exhibit their understanding, their own personal experience and understanding, by writing something about it. And so he says, the one whose phrase is telling most profoundly with the intent of the teaching, the intent of the teaching is for all of you to realize enlightenment. Another way of saying to realize the truth, that profound nature that each and every one of us actually have within us or are part of. And so the phrase that tallies most profoundly with the fact that you've actually realized, awakened to your own true nature, will receive both the kesa and the teaching. And the kesa and the teaching, there are what are called the transmission books that get passed on. And the kesa, you may have seen me wearing a much larger purple covering during morning service, that's the full kesa. And back then, the kesa he had would get passed on to his next in line teacher. So it was done traditionally that way. So at that time, Jinshu, a senior monk in charge of ceremonial training for more than 700 junior members of the Sangha, so they had a big monastery, was well versed in the inner and outer meanings of doctrines. So the assembly looked up to him. They all excused themselves from writing a poem, pleading that if it were not the worthy Jinshu, who could possibly be more suited to this task? So everybody's recognizing that this guy Jinshu, he's the cat's meow. Is that the right phrase? So Jinshu apparently was very nervous about actually just going to the abbot and giving him his poem or reciting his poem. So apparently the story goes that at midnight, so it says that night at midnight, without informing anyone, he wrote his verse by lantern light on the wall of the south corridor, presenting what his mind had perceived. And his poem read, "Our mind is a Bodhi tree, our mind like a dressing stand with its clear mirror. Time upon time, let us strive to wipe it clean and let not dust or dirt abide thereon." I want to read one other translation for you, because oftentimes it can be helpful. Remember, this was written in Chinese. This particular book called the Denkaroku was written back in the 1200s in Japan. So here's this other translation. "Our body is the Bodhi tree, and our mind a mirror bright. Carefully we wipe them hour by hour, and let no dust alight." Sounds a little more poetic, that one. Our body is as the Bodhi tree. At least one of the aspects of what's being referenced here is that the Bodhi tree is referring to the tree that the historical Buddha sat under when he realized enlightenment. And our mind, a mirror bright, and Reverend Master Hubert's translation, of course, is indicating that the part of what's being implied is that it's, you know, like a dressing stand. So basically, our form of meditation is translated as serene reflection meditation. There are two aspects of our meditation. The serene part is the calmness aspect of it. The sitting still, the mind being still, the relaxing into, the calming into, just sitting with ourselves. And the awareness that we're cultivating is, so we're called serene reflection meditation, and reflection is not in the sense of reflecting on things like thinking about them or looking at them. It's more reflecting as in a mirror, in the sense of just simply observing, noting, being aware of objects coming and going, thoughts, feelings, physical sensations, and so on. And like a mirror, you know, with things that appear in a mirror and so on and just arise and pass away, there's no stickiness. The mirror could care less what you show in it. You know, it doesn't stick. Doesn't get stuck in the image of the mirror, so to speak. Now, the way I just said that, he's not actually taking it that way in this poem. He's then adding two more lines and saying, carefully we wipe them hour by hour. We wipe the Bodhi tree, we wipe our body, we wipe our mind, and let no dust alight. So again, this book, the Dankaroku, was written by Great Master Keizan. And so this is basically his story. He's the one passing on his teaching about, he basically has all the ancestors. He gives sort of a biographical, spiritual biographical account of each ancestor, all the way up to the time of the founder of Soto Zen, Great Master Dogen, back in the 1200s in Japan. And so this is his take on the exchange, the story he would have heard, which back at the time would have been happening only 500 or 600 years ago. So kind of like us looking back on the story of the Pilgrims landing in 1620 and, you know, the founding of the United States or something. And so not too far away, but far enough that we can embellish it and all that stuff. Okay, so he's just written this poem of his understanding on the wall of the corridor in the monastery. And Daimon, the abbot, suddenly spotted this poem whilst passing through the corridor, and upon reading it, knew that it was the work of Jinshu. He praised it, saying, if succeeding generations put the teaching of this poem into practice, they too will find the surpassing fruits of Buddhahood. And he had everyone recite it aloud from memory. Okay, so it's really important. I mean, I know there are a number of you listening to this who know this story and have read the second half of it. What does the illiterate poor guy who's been pounding rice for the last 2 years, what's the verse that he puts up on the wall of the corridor? That's a spoiler, by the way, but he puts something interesting on there. And it's important for us to realize that that particular verse that I read, the abbot is saying, if succeeding generations put the teaching of this poem into practice, they too will find the surpassing fruits of Buddhahood. If they do this practice in this verse, they will eventually realize Buddhahood. They will find, they will attain, they will experience what this teaching is all about. So I want us to look at this a little more deeply in terms of what's being said here before we go on to part two, which at this point we're going to do next Sunday. The second part, because we need to give it its proper due also. So basically, he's talking about the practice really emphasizing striving, working, making effort to wipe the mirror clean and not let dust or dirt abide on it. I mean, not that I want to put any of you on the spot, but I could easily ask any one of you and you could easily come up with telling me what you would regard as dirt or dust in your life. From a Buddhist point of view, we can come at this from a number of different perspectives, but the dust and dirt that's being spoken of has to do with basically grasping onto things or pushing them away. It has to do with acting on our desires or pushing things away, our aversions. We use a formula phrase of greed, anger, and delusion. As I've described how we do our meditation practice, when we're sitting and meditating, we're becoming aware of mental activity, the emotions, the physical sensations that arise in being with ourselves. And we notice when we grab onto various things. We notice when we want to push certain things away. And over time, if we look really, really carefully, look very, very closely, what's occurring in formal seated meditation is just kind of a microcosm. It's a reflection of what's going on in the rest of our daily life. There are these various areas where we try to grab onto things. We want things to be certain ways. We don't want things to be other ways. And so what we're practicing in meditation is learning how to not grab onto and not push away. The reason for that is that the very fundamental teachings in Buddhism are saying that when we act on our greeds, when we act on our desires, when we act on our aversions, when we push things away, that actually leads to, is the cause of suffering in our lives. That's actually what is the producer of dissatisfactoriness in our lives. So what he's saying is that very, very, very diligently is to be aware of all of the ways in which we continue to grasp onto things and continue to push things away. And also it's very, very helpful to be aware of our blind spots, which is kind of, a blind spot is something you're not aware of, but we can be increasingly aware of areas where it's kind of like, okay, it's pretty dark or black in that area. I don't know what's going on, but it seems to affect my life in a number of ways. So it's like, okay, I'm just going to flag that area in my life as something to be, you know, take care with. Now, greed, anger, and delusion, desires, aversions, that's what's being touched on. That's what's being talked about. That's what's being pointed to in the Buddhist precepts. And the Buddhist precepts are just a slightly more broken down way of talking about the various ways in which we grab onto things and push things away. So in essence, what this verse is saying is, kind of the core of it is, fundamentally, we need to be living a preceptual life. We need to be living a life that is sort of increasingly, you know, I mean, we're all work in progress. We're all learning about the areas that we get caught in, that we have difficulties with. And we're learning over time to see the grabbing onto, the pushing away, and learn how to work with that over time. That's why I said when I was up at the altar, so at the age of, I think it was 35, that's when the historical Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree and had his awakening, had his enlightenment experience. And he ended up living for 44 more years, living, teaching. But he always lived the robes of a monk, the kesa in particular, is representative of that ethical and moral, that very preceptual way of living our lives. Gwen and Nancy are both wearing, you can see they're wearing a black. That's the equivalent for lay practitioners of the monk's kesa. And again, in part, you know, they have that because they went through the formal ceremonies down at our main monastery at Shasta Abbey and actually took the precepts, wished to become official Buddhists, as basically stating that that's the foundational way they want to live their lives and have that be kind of their grounding way of living their life. So the verse again that he wrote is saying that you need to have that foundation for a spiritual practice. You need to live in a very particular way. We also have another phrase that says, enlightened action leaves no wake. You know, like the wake of a motorboat going by, which I well remember when we had this tiny little rowboat on a lake and some big cruiser would go by. Of course, you know, I was 9 or 10, we thought it was the coolest thing. Ooh, let's try to capsize, but we can kind of extend that, and we can look at certain political leaders on the world landscape who are leaving some very, very big wakes. And that's what's being talked about. The wake that you're leaving is proportional to the, I should say inversely proportional to the precepts you're following, i.e. not very many. There was a very interesting phenomena that occurred. I was too young. I didn't even know about Buddhism when I was in grade school, but when Reverend Master Jiu was first starting out Shasta Abbey in the late 60s and early 70s, and Zen was very, very popular in the San Francisco Bay Area in the 60s. That was, of course, the hippie era. And as I gather, people were really, really, really big on Zen because Zen said you can be completely free. Of course, that's what most people back in those days wanted. And yet, come to find out that their understanding of freedom and Zen's understanding of freedom were a little bit different. And Reverend Master Jiu spent a lot of time working with the very young people who came there to become monks, to teach them that the freedom they're talking about is built on this foundation of living your life in a respectful, responsible, ethical, and moral way. And what I remember, I'd been a monk about 15 years or so when my master died, the master who gave me the transmission. And to say the least, it was very traumatic to have him die, as it was for the rest of us. And we all have these very trying and difficult times in our lives when things can get very rough and shaky. And what I found was so amazing and such a support was the structure, as it were, the guidelines, the precepts, the regularly giving oneself to one's meditation practice. And although I was in a state, as were many of us, it's like, oh, you just do what you've always done. You know, you get up, you go to meditation, you go to morning service, you work, you do your job within all that context, and you allow all of these difficult, trying times to naturally work their way through, which they did, and they do. But I brought that up just to kind of show again that the real importance of that structure, that foundation of the practice. You know, I know for some of you, you're here at the Priory for, you know, one of your first or second or third times, just seeing what we're like. But hopefully this has given you a sense of, you know, I said there's part two next Sunday. This is giving you kind of the real baseline of what's so important and valuable in our training. And it's leading a perceptual life as we understand it, and that understanding grows over time. Living a perceptual life, working on our greeds and our aversions, our delusions, and so on, that, as the abbot said, that will actually lead to the fruits of Buddhahood. One of the interesting things, and it doesn't, well, I think in the West, and kind of in this day and age in the United States, so I can't believe I'm about ready to say this because there are a lot of indications that it's otherwise also, but let's say there are certain threads in, more than threads in American culture, where we really value the intellect. We really value thinking about things, studying things, learning about things. And what's very interesting is that Buddhist teaching, particularly Zen teachings, can be very sort of mentally, intellectually exciting and appealing. That's fine. But River Master Jiu would always, you know, she'd get people excitedly coming to her and saying that they want to realize the fruits of Buddhahood. They want the whole thing. And she'd be like, well, how about next time you go into the meditation hall, you put your slippers straight? You know, how about next time you come, please take your shoes off before you come inside? In other words, she was saying that how you actually conduct your life, how you live your life, not what your thoughts are. I can think anything I want, but how I'm being as a person and how I'm impacting all of those around me, that's where it all starts. It's kind of like, how are we living our life on the ground? And then allow that to build from there. And of course, there were some people like, that's too mundane. How can that possibly lead to enlightenment? That's why Enno, when he met the abbot, and he said, there are southerners, there are northerners. What does that have to do with the truth? In other words, you know, the truth isn't affected by that in any way. This guy knew something. The abbot actually had to test him, not in a manipulative way, but in a very natural way. He had to see, okay, what he just said, those were pretty good words. How do I know he didn't just come from some other Zen master and he's just parroting that? He memorized that. So he said, okay, you can be a part of this community. You have to go to the rice pounding shed and work there. And he did. And he continued to do that for over 700 days in and out. That's somebody who's exhibiting their understanding of Buddhism by how they actually live their life, how they conduct themselves. And that's somebody who's a very stable foundation, who can receive the deeper teachings. Why? Because they've exhibited this steadiness, this consistency, this stability. They know about, you just do this practice day in and day out, when it's good, when it's bad, when you feel like it, when you don't feel like it. What's interesting is that my experience is you come into, you know, again, I can only speak about being a monk, basically. I came in as a young monk. Yes, I wanted this. You know, I'd read some good stuff. That's what I want. And then they asked me to do these various jobs. And partway along the way, you're kind of like, oh, when am I going to get acknowledged? When are they going to tell me I'm doing really well? When are they going to actually let me take the next step in the hierarchy? You know, and sometimes you bring that up and they're like, oh, no, you're not ready yet. Just drop it. Just carry on with what you're doing. And usually the way it happens is that somebody finally just hears that and they just get on with doing the daily practice, the seemingly mundane practice. And the way it happened for me, the way it happened for many, many monks that I know, is that one of the masters just sidled up to you one day and said, "I'd like to offer you the transmission." Takes you completely by surprise because you're just getting on with what's at hand. And I don't want to overstate it or overemphasize it, lest I'm repeating it too often. Because I was just getting on with it, because I was just trusting the practice, that's indicative that you've already received at some level the transmission. You're already living from that truth. You don't know it yet. That comes later. To the masters around you, the senior monks around you, you're already exhibiting that you get it. You're already doing the practice. So why don't I leave it at that? And then we'll see next Sunday what great Master Kazon has to say about the rice pounder's verse words. Remember, he was illiterate. He didn't even know how to write. So how's he going to do that? And I know I've been talking about monks, and my apologies for that. I'm not meaning it to be highlighting monks as being anything better or more than anyone else. It's more, these are just illustrating some fairly important teachings that are accessible to all of us.